need such a long and complicated password? That's a question I often get from new producers at PI Media, my podcast production company. Then, after listening to a couple of Malicious Life episodes, they too start using long and complicated passwords. But remembering and keeping track of multiple strong passwords isn't easy, and having to constantly reset your employees' forgotten passwords can be a real hassle for any business. That's where 1Password comes in. With 1Password, all you have to remember is just one strong password that protects everything else. 1Password combines industry-leading security with award-winning design. That's why it's trusted by over 100,000 businesses and millions of users. Right now, Malicious Life listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/malicious. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/malicious. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to 1Password.com/malicious. Hi, and welcome to Cyber Reason's Malicious Life. So this is not going to be your typical Malicious Life episode. We usually prefer to tell our stories in a narrative manner, but this is going to be an interview-based episode. We've done quite a few episodes like this in the past, what we call B-sides, usually on topics that don't quite fit the usual mold of the podcast, but are still worth talking about. The topic of this B-side episode is supply chain lessons learned from last month's Grim Reaper attack against Hezbollah in Lebanon. For those of our listeners who are out of the loop, on 17 and 18 of September 2024, thousands of pagers and handheld radio devices used by Hezbollah exploded simultaneously across Lebanon and Syria, killing at least 42 terrorists and wounding more than 3,000. Now, this isn't an episode on the attack itself. That episode is still in the works and will allow us to dig much deeper into the attack and how the Israeli Mossad was able to pull it off than what's possible in a single interview. This conversation will focus on what governments and organizations can learn from Grim Reaper with regards to supply chain attacks. Because, as some of you might already know, Grim Reaper was a result of one of the most sophisticated supply chain attacks in history. Our guest is Devon Ackerman, Cyber Reason's Global Head of Digital Forensic and Incident Response. Devon is a former special agent at the FBI's Operational Technology Division and served as a senior certified forensic examiner for on-scene collections and forensic analysis. He's the author of the best-selling book Diving In, An Incident Responder's Journey, and creator of AboutDFear.com, a website dedicated for resources for digital forensics and incident response. In my conversation with Devon, we discussed how such traumatic events impact the mindset of hacked organizations, what kind of threat actors are capable of pulling off long-term attacks like these, and the 3 most important steps an organization can take to minimize the chance of a supply chain attack. Enjoy the interview. So we are here to discuss one of the most, I think, talked about events in the history of cybersecurity, certainly one of the most intriguing events that happened in recent years, which is the Grim Reaper operation against the Hezbollah terrorist organization in Lebanon. Most of our listeners probably have heard about that operation, but maybe let's, you know, give them all the basic idea of what happened just a few weeks ago.
This entire operation that the kind of internet and governments are dubbing Operation Grim Reaper was a multi-year long operation likely by the forces of Israel for purposes of one day being able to disable and dismember members of Hezbollah. What we know at a high level is that many years ago, an operation looks like it was put into effect to manufacture and assemble these pagers. And that is what I think probably most of the audience has seen and read. The piece though that's interesting is, why were pagers chosen? And that's a piece I'd love to spend a couple of seconds talking through. Now, Hezbollah, over the years, really since beginning of many of the wars where Hezbollah's name has been known in the current generation, for the last 10, 20 plus years, as the conflicts have gone through the Middle East, Hezbollah and other organizations are very aware, as most modern governments are, that there are threat actors, cyber threat actors. That is the current scope of the battlefield now. And that modern cell phones, smartphones that we all carry, we all rely upon, iPhone to Android, back in the day to BlackBerry, these are targets. I could actually track you. I could potentially install malware. It's a lot of capabilities, even down to the pictures you take and the social media footprint you leave. Hezbollah had put out information in recent years about moving away from monitorable technologies. And they had moved towards kind of the older school technologies that I grew up with. Pagers, right? Beepers, we called them back in the day. And you know, you got a text message, or really wasn't even a text message. It was just a phone number to call. Occasionally you could get clever and you could send extra digits to the end, but it's very basic technology. And so organizations like Hezbollah had put out directives to move away from modern technology for internal usage. It's now coming to light that Israel, a very good operation and job in mapping how they were going to move to this older, this more antiquated technology. And they mapped the supply chain from the order process, the manufacturing process. And it can be probably surmised based on the outcome that they cleverly and surreptitiously were able to take advantage of that supply chain process of the pagers being manufactured, shipping, delivery, and eventually ending up in the hands of the individuals to do what we now know was the insertion of explosives for later military use.
Yeah, so from what we know, probably a few thousand terrorists were either killed or badly injured in that attack. So it was a pretty devastating blow for the terrorist organization, probably. We don't know yet what is the impact on Hezbollah's military capabilities, but I think we can start to assess the psychological impact of that operation on Hezbollah's operatives. What do you think is the psychological impact of that operation?
That's a great question. So let's liken that a little bit to, you know, a network intrusion. In a network intrusion, which I've worked these now for nearly 15, 20 years, you'll have a company and they think they're secure. They think they're patched. They think they have an investment in their technology, that they have a team monitoring what's going on, the information flow in and out of their environment. But one day, someone does gain unauthorized access. And the psychological impact of that is very similar to what I imagine happened with Operation Grim Reaper, that a device, trusted, considered as low tech, was ultimately compromised. And even beyond just the fact that it was compromised, it allowed for an attack to happen in places of assumed safety, right? Homes, offices, underground locations, as many of the open source information reporting is coming out where these explosions occurred, that psychological impact on the target was very much how we see in network intrusions, where companies, victims of cybercrime, feel they're safe within their business. They feel they're safe within their email account. And someone comes along through exploit, through phishing, ultimately gains access and compromises that safety net.
From your experience, as somebody who worked with such organizations who suffered an attack, what changes in an organization, in the way it operates, in the way its leaders think about security, once they suffer such an intrusion after having believed that they are safe? Does that change their mindset in a way?
My guidance and what I've observed with victims of cybercrime has been that 9 times out of 10, they never want the thing to happen again. Whatever the bad experience was, whether it was costly, whether it was such a significant business interruption event that it has altered their entire revenue stream, their focus is, how do we do better? And one of the things that I've learned is explaining how it happened is as important as explaining how to raise the defense of the organization to minimize the likelihood of it not happening again. And when you take those two pieces of the conversation and you try to articulate that to someone who's been through what can be a very salacious event, you can help form the narrative by explaining how the intrusion happened, explaining the root cause. And then what I like to do is, as an engagement manager, I walk through the timeline. You know, many victims of cybercrime realize something's wrong when the proverbial boom has happened. And not to continue drawing parallels with Operation Grim Reaper, but, you know, even in investigations and incident response, we draw a parallel that there's this moment we call right of boom, where ransomware happens, where the wire transfer is intercepted, where the insider threat steals the data. And you have this moment where we're no longer preparing for the event. We're not proactively working on defenses. We're responding to an event, the boom, right? And so just like Operation Grim Reaper, and to your question, clients want to deal with the moment of the boom. And I try to get them and guide them through that. My team does that. And as everything calms down, we show them, how did it happen? For them, their day one was the boom, the ransomware event, the moment their business stopped operating. And for us, that's probably day 10, day 15, day 30 for when the threat actor and their timeline had occurred. And so I try to show that whole timeline, and that really opens the eyes. It educates. And then we turn that into, this is how we can try to prevent this in the future.
It sounds as if that these kinds of traumatic events are also opportunities for security professionals, the CISOs of organizations, etc., to actually make use of the trauma in order to improve the security posture of an organization. Is that a true assessment?
I think it is. And that has been my observation over the years. I think any one of your listeners who would, you know, be able to raise their hand and say, I've been through an event, they'd probably all say a very similar thing, that what we learned from the event, from the investigation, was eye-opening. And I hope most of those listeners are then able to also say what I've seen, which is we were able to turn what we learned from the event into a better building block, a better defense measure later. Now, that's sometimes easier said than done. And what I try to do is say, look, this is not a single solution to fix one catch-all where you'll never be hacked again. Threat actors only have to be right once. And any modern business, any modern enterprise has thousands, tens of thousands of weaknesses. They may do really good with endpoint detection and response, EDR. They may do really well with their investment in their firewalls, their perimeter security, but threat actor only has to have one zero day or one successful phishing email to get in. And once they're in, that intrusion path starts. And so, yes, what we try to do is educate and say, this isn't about just putting a better phishing detection system in. This is about an educational change and then the raising of the defenses as a roadmap. Because whatever a vulnerability is today, there will be a new vulnerability tomorrow. And a year from now, there will be a new technology. And so we want to show that there's a journey, there's a value over time in building a roadmap. And then the key, the most key thing, is properly funding it. Many businesses, many clients who've been through victimization of their network, of their business, they sometimes think very singularly of, this event happened, how do I fix this event and I can go back to normal? And what I try to do is show, what my teams try to do is show that this is a security is a journey. We're going to use this as the baseline, help you understand this as a roadmap going forward, work on an incident response plan, work on beginning to do tabletop exercises with your board, with your executive team, with your IT team, and we slowly raise the educational over time and build the budget into the pieces that'll make them more secure as time goes on.
There's a great saying, every crisis is an opportunity. So even such a traumatic event can be an opportunity to improve things in the future. Have we encountered in our modern history similar attacks to Green Beeper in the way they were implemented or their impact or, you know, something similar to Green Beeper?
We have. So there have been some very interesting cases over the years. And, you know, one supply chain attack in recent years was the 3CX incident.
Devin mentioned the 3CX attack, so here's a quick recap of that incident, which actually deserves a full Malicious Life episode someday. In March 2023, Mandiant, a cybersecurity firm, investigated an incident that affected the 3CX desktop app. 3CX is an enterprise communications software that was compromised so that a Trojanized version of the software became available for download directly from the company's own website. Mandiant's investigation revealed that the attack involved, for the first time in cybersecurity history, a double or cascading supply chain attack. The attackers hacked a third-party software supplier for a company called Trading Technologies, which provides an app called Xtrader. Xtrader was later installed on a 3CX employee's computer, allowing the hackers to access 3CX's network, corrupt the 3CX installer application, and infect many of its customers. It was a fascinating attack, which, similar to Green Beeper, likely required extensive long-term planning. And now, back to the interview.
It was a double supply chain attack. Another IR vendor believes and kind of points the finger at an Asia-based government, potentially behind that, or a group called Lazarus, and that group had a likely end goal to get into a particular organization, and they couldn't directly. So they determined who that organization did business with, business-to-business relationships. And they ultimately went almost like a ring approach. They said, okay, this company, who is our target, they do business with this company and this company. They also have very good defenses. Maybe we go upstream one more layer. And we want to get to company A. We're going to get through it by going and hitting company B. And we're going to start with company C. And it sounds fairly complex. But what was interesting about it, and again, you can read much of this in open source, is that the Lazarus group, I actually write about this group in my book, but this group over time successfully intruded into company C. They compromised a piece of software. They impersonated relationships, and they were able to pass that maliciousness into company B. And they leveraged that as a trusted piece of software, an accepted piece of software, to ultimately downstream business-to-business relationship to company A. It took likely years for this operation to happen. Very probably similar to how Operation Grim Beeper probably took over many, many years. And this is one of the hallmarks, this kind of multi-year, expensive, patient operation. This is a hallmark of what we call nation state threat actor groups, because those groups are very focused on creating long-term gains. And those long-term gains sometimes aren't a quick win. They take years of planning, patience, and that is very similar to what we saw with the 3CX and the customers, trading technology and others, just like we saw with SolarWinds, another example, over the years. And there's very good write-ups and open source on these. But we've learned from these attacks that when you have a threat actor who's interested, regardless of the country, right? When a threat actor has a focused end goal, they will take time and patience to achieve that goal.
So it's reasonable to expect that nation state actors, such as the Lazarus Group, who is affiliated with North Korea, we have a lot of APT groups, even the NSA has pulled off some great operations in the past, at least according to the Snowden leaks, for example. A nation state actor, we can assume that it thinks in the long term. How about non-state actors? Do they have the capacity, the capability to pull such an operation of thinking for years ahead to reach their goals?
It's a great question. So as you move on the other side of the pendulum of threat actors, and I kind of refer to this as the threat landscape, you have another large group of what I kind of consider e-crime or organized crime groups. Now, that doesn't mean that lone wolves aren't typically lumped into this, but organized crime in the sense of financial motivation. And this group, to your question around, are they capable of sophisticated long-term operations? I would say there's probably a small percentage of organized crime groups that I have observed over the years are. But one of the differences with organized crime groups is that financial piece. They're interested in the payout. This is how they're funding their operation. You know, for a government, for a nation state threat actor, they're funded very differently. If it's a job for them, right? They're part of a military. They're part of an intelligence group. That's a very different focus and motivation. But with organized criminals, this is their livelihood. This is their paycheck. And that, to your question of, are there groups within this spectrum that can do long-term impacts, long-term operations? I think the answer is yes. There have been organized crime groups observed over the years that almost turn into these ransomware as a service models. And they use the funneling of the money through the misappropriated stolen data and the negotiation of the payment cycles to fund sophisticated malware. It becomes almost a business model for them. They hack, or they pay people to hack, they steal data, they encrypt the data, they receive a payment, and they funnel that money in to pay for the development of technology. And we've seen certain threat actors who then have leveraged that to even buy exploits and fund research and development of exploits. So now suddenly a fully patched firewall, it's not a nation state that's researched, you know, your Snowden example, research something sophisticated. It's now an actual organized crime group because they had money and they spent that time to research an exploit. And now we have a rise in 0 days. You know, there's a very interesting trend that I've observed in the last 10 years. Going back to 2014, I've been tracking critical vulnerabilities, or CVEs. And these common, you know, these vulnerabilities, the trend, if you look at the mappings of them, and there's a really good website, cvedetails.com, that website has a tracker on it. Every single year, from 2014 to present, it has gone up in the amount of vulnerabilities being identified, documented, and addressed year over year over year. I don't think it's that we're getting better at reporting them. I think it's this funding of research and development to find exploits to continue financial focused, organized criminality. And there's really big groups, large, fairly sophisticated groups that absolutely are capable and have shown they're capable of long-term operations.
We could probably spend a whole hour talking about how to prevent supply chain attacks, but what are, you know, your top two or maybe top three recommendations for organizations wish to mitigate the risks from such third-party suppliers attack?
So top two or three. Ooh, I like this question because, look, I have a whole list of recommendations, but there are a couple of easier, quicker wins. Now, they may not be easy to implement. They may not be necessarily the most cost effective, but if you're looking for kind of the broadest controls from a security standpoint, for resilience, for detecting, like we've been kind of talking about today, detecting and putting road bumps in to identify an intrusion, then here's my two or three. Endpoint detection and response technologies. Or really what is it's becoming is extended detection response technologies, or XDR is kind of the buzzword. Regardless of the buzzword, regardless of the technology, something that helps monitor not just your computers and servers, but your ecosystem of technologies, your cloud, your virtualizations, your perimeter logging. Something that allows you to singularly pull in the telemetry, the logging, the data, normalize that information, and then detect and respond, right? So less focus on the actual sensor, less focus on who you're buying it from, less focus on the product. The thought, the theme of a detection response capability for the ecosystem of the business. That's my number one recommendation from a security control standpoint. And a lot of people think of security controls as, you know, almost like the physical door key or the fob that gets you in and out of the building, or the username password. And look, we can say multi-factor authentication is a second essential control. I would hope in this day and age, multi-factor is fairly standard with most of the listeners. But I'm going to assume credentials, multi-factor will be compromised in some aspect of an intrusion path for a threat actor. So that's why I start with a detection response capability. Because if we assume we're going to be compromised, then we need to have a proper process in place to detect it, contain it, eject it, and fully respond to that intrusion path. So that's my first. My second is planning. If we want to raise the educational and security capability of our people, then we have to plan. We have to train. You know, one of the things I learned when I was in the FBI is you train the way that one day you're going to have to react to. You know, in law enforcement, regularly, we do firearms qualifications because, God forbid, one day we have to respond to protect life and limb. We have to respond with deadly force. We need to have trained. So we train. That's an aspect of law enforcement, just like the military. You don't want a tank crew touching the tank for the first time when they're in conflict. You want them training. You want them to be the experts. It's the same thing in cybersecurity, which means it's the same thing in business. If we're going to assume that one day we're going to have an event, why don't we train? And not just three or four people in IT, the business should train, which leads me to my second one, incident response planning and tabletop exercises. Lots of organizations offer these. I've guided and delivered tabletops for years. It's rewarding because you get to see a client with that light bulb moment when they realize, oh, I hadn't thought of that. Or how are we going to deal with that? Or, you mean that's possible? And so incident response planning, tabletop exercises, give a client an opportunity to experience the possibility of an event before they need to break the glass, before there actually is an event. So we started with endpoint detection response. The second would be IRPs and TTXs, incident response planning and tabletop exercises. And my last one, the one that I often see the widest array of oddities with, is good access controls. Many, many businesses start out with solid, robust, we're going to do this right, this is a brand new company, and they start with really good concepts when they're small. And the one person in IT or the one person in management or the one person in HR, they are the holders to the keys to the kingdom. But as the business grows, the organization expands, as it becomes not 10 employees, but 10,000 employees, I repeatedly, over and over and over again, doing investigations, observe very poorly managed access controls within the organization for groups of individuals or service accounts or users that have expanded privileges that they don't necessarily need, or software that's installed that everyone has access to when really only a key group should have it, or wide open or more open than they should have permissions on file servers or cloud share locations. We need to move to a security principle of lesser access is okay. It may cause the help desk to get more requests, but that's okay. I mean, move to that type of a discipline where if someone needs it, they don't necessarily need it for forever. They need it for a set goal, job, portion of their employment, and they're going to move on to the next project. So let's containerize. Let's put controls in the way we'll access, because that's what a threat actor is going to abuse when they get in. They're going to navigate and identify how to abuse and misuse existing over-provisioned access to navigate to their end goal. So detection response capabilities, training through incident response planning and through tabletop exercises, and access controls where you help secure the organization by adopting good practices from the beginning. Those would be my three recommendations.
Okay, so one of the reasons that the Mossad was able to attack so many Hezbollah's operatives simultaneously was because every one of them was using the same pager, the same beeper. And there's always a kind of tension inside of an organization between homogeneity in technology and heterogeneity in technology. For example, if everybody uses the same operating system, then everybody is vulnerable to a zero day detected in that operating system. But if one employee uses Linux, one uses Windows, the other a Mac, then you get no single zero day could damage every employee in a sense, but it becomes very hard to manage, right? I mean, it's difficult to manage from an IT perspective so many different systems. But from a security, purely security perspective, what is better, heterogeneity or homogeneity in technology?
Oh, that is a very interesting question. So I think I'd answer it like this. From a threat actor perspective, and to your point, if the entire landscape of my victim's network is the same type of technology, then a singular exploit, to exactly your point, allows me to do the most damage. If I, though, have all these different technologies within the organization, I will likely be successful in taking out pieces of the organization, of the network, but not the totality of it, or not the totality without much more time and much more change up of tooling and processes in the intrusion path. So I think, while I would love to see more of the mismatch, if you will, the mix and matching of technology and organizations, it is rare that I see it because of the financial aspect. So, and within organizations, sometimes it is easier not only to manage from an IT perspective, like you said, when you have one or two or three type technologies, it also becomes a financial or budget thing. At the end of the day, that budget to invest in the next security aspect, you want the a proper balance between that and the investment in the IT side. So ultimately, if you have disparate technologies in the organization, it still comes back to some of those fundamental security technologies so that you can help detect and respond regardless of one or two all-encompassing technologies or a smattering of technologies throughout the organization.
Devon Ackerman, thank you very, very much. Very interesting conversation.
It has been my absolute pleasure. I look forward to talking to you in the future on another topic.
CK Music.